Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Great to be here.
So this is where we take the sources you've sent our way and really get into them. Today, we've got quite a stack. It's all articles from Tech Central, that's South Africa's leading business tech news site.
Yep. And the plan is to basically pull out the most important bits, the key insights from some of the main stories that hit Tech Central over the last week or so.
Exactly. It's about giving you that shortcut, right? Helping you get informed on the big developments without having to wade through everything yourself.
Think of it as your curated guide. We're here to help you make sense of these crucial nuggets of information.
And it's a really interesting mix this week. It paints quite a picture of the SA tech scene.
Definitely. We're seeing stories about corporate governance, market pressures, regulatory fights.
Even how the big global tech players view Africa, it really covers a lot of ground.
It does. So let's dive into this stack and see what stands out for you.
Okay, sounds good. Where should we start? How about with that corporate governance story? It feels like a recurring theme, unfortunately.
You mean the IO Technology Solutions one?
Yeah, exactly. They seem to be back in the news, and well, not exactly for the best reasons again, involving the JSE.
That's right. Tech Central reported that IO is once again facing trouble with the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. There's been another finding against them.
Okay, so what's the specific issue this time? What did the JSE actually do?
Well, the JSE handed down a R500,000 fine and a public censure.
R500,000? That sounds significant.
It is, but there's a catch, a condition attached.
Oh, which is?
That fine, it's suspended for 5 years. The catch is they can't commit a similar breach of the JSE's listing requirements during that time.
Okay. So it's more of a warning shot, really. Pay up if you mess up again like this.
Precisely. A very clear signal from the regulator.
So what was the breach? What rule did they actually break to get this suspended fine and censure?
The core issue, according to the JSE's finding, was that IO effectively kept important information away from his shareholders for nearly 2 months.
2 months. Wow. That's a long time in market terms. What kind of information are we talking about?
Well, it all stems from a cautionary announcement IO put out back in March 2023.
Okay.
And that cautionary was related to some pretty significant legal action involving IO, the Public Investment Corporation, the PIC, and the Government Employees Pension Fund, the GEPF.
Ah, right. The whole saga around the PIC's huge and very controversial investment in IO before it listed. That R4.3 billion, wasn't it?
That's the one. Back in 2017, the PIC put in R4.3 billion for a 29% stake just before the listing. And then, as we know, the value plummeted. A PIC lost most of that money.
Which led to the legal action, the PIC trying to undo the deal.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
They were trying to get that original 2017 investment agreement declared unlawful. They alleged things like misleading information, irregular processes,
Yeah.
basically saying the whole foundation of the investment was flawed.
So a massive legal fight brewing over billions, and the cautionary announcement was about that fight. But then in March 2023, the sources say they reached a settlement. Yeah.
Exactly. On the 24th of March, 2023, IO announced that the legal stuff was over. They had reached an amicable settlement with the PIC and GEPF. So they said they were withdrawing the cautionary.
Okay, sounds like good news on the surface, settling a major lawsuit. But this is where the JSE problem starts, I take it.
Precisely. Because in that announcement on March 24th, IO explicitly stated they were not going to include the specific terms of the settlement. They cited confidentiality.
Okay.
But then, literally the next day, March 25th, various media outlets published articles. And those articles did contain significant details about the settlement terms.
Uh-oh. So the market found out through the media before the company officially disclosed it. What kind of details are we talking about?
Key details, things that directly impact shareholders and the company's finances, like IO agreeing to buy back shares held by the GEPF for around R600 million,
Wow.
and
Okay.
granting the GEBF a further option to sell more shares back later. Plus, certain minority protections for the GEPF.
So, news of a massive R600 million share buyback linked to settling this huge legal dispute hits the press before the company tells its own shareholders. That sounds like a major disclosure failure.
It does. And this is where the JSE rules are crystal clear. Their listings requirements state that if a company agrees to the terms of a specific share repurchase like this, it must publish the full details immediately, as soon as the terms are agreed.
Which the JSE determined was March 24th.
Exactly. That's when the disclosure should have happened, with all the details.
But instead, IO just published a withdrawal of cautionary, leaving out those crucial repurchase terms.
Correct. They did put out something later they called a voluntary announcement, but the JSE found that also didn't meet the requirements. It didn't have the necessary disclosures or approvals needed for a transaction of this nature and scale.
So the JSE had to step in.
They did. The JSE actually had to direct IO on April 4th, 2023, to make a proper announcement that complied with the rules.
And when did IO finally publish that directed announcement?
Not until May 18th, 2023.
May 18th? That's what, 6 or 7 weeks after the JSE told them to? And almost 2 months after the settlement was first announced without the detail.
Yeah, nearly 2 months of delay. And the JSE was pretty clear about the impact.
What did they say?
They stated explicitly that this lack of timely full disclosure could have hampered shareholders' ability to make informed decisions about buying or selling IO shares. They said it potentially undermined transparency and fair market practices, which is, you know, exactly what the JSE rules are there to prevent.
And that's why they issued the censure and the suspended fine. Even though it's suspended, it's a formal finding of a serious breach.
Absolutely.
Now, this isn't exactly IO's first brush with JSE censure or governance issues, is it? The sources sort of paint a picture of a company with a bit of a track record here.
They certainly do. TechCentral notes IO has been in the headlines for years for all the wrong reasons, which is quite blunt. They mention numerous previous censures from the JSE for failing to comply with listing rules, a history of financial misstatements, other governance failings.
Weren't they suspended from trading at one point recently?
Yes, they were temporarily suspended in February 2025, specifically because they failed to get their financial statements published on time.
So regulatory compliance seems to be a, let's say, persistent challenge. And this latest story might actually be one of the last chapters in their JSE saga. There's talk of delisting.
That's a really significant development mentioned in the sources, yes. IO recently announced that Sekenjalo Investment Holdings, which is controlled by Iqbal Survey, intends to make an offer to buy out all the remaining minority shareholders.
Ahead of a potential delisting.
That seems to be the plan. If they succeed and delist the company, IO would no longer be subject to the JSE's listings requirements and oversight.
Right. Escape the regulatory spotlight. What's Sekenjalo offering the minorities?
The offer price is 52 cents per share.
52 cents.
Yep. The total amount to buy out all the minorities comes to about R80.8 million.
R80.8 million compared to the R4.3 billion the PIC initially put in.
It's a stark contrast, isn't it?
Hmm.
That R80.8 million for all the minority shares is less than 2% of the value the PIC invested back in 2017. It just underscores the immense destruction of shareholder value that's happened since the listing.
A period marked by these repeated governance issues and controversies.
Exactly.
So pulling this all together, what's the main takeaway for you, the listener, watching the South African market?
Look, this IO story is really a potent reminder of how absolutely critical corporate governance and timely full disclosure are for any listed company. It's the bedrock of investor trust.
If you can't trust the information flow, how can you make decisions?
Precisely. It also highlights the role regulators like the JSE play in trying to enforce those standards, even if, you know, penalties sometimes get suspended. It's about setting expectations.
And it shows the real-world impact when things go wrong.
Absolutely. It's a clear, if unfortunate, example of the potential consequences for shareholders, massive loss of value, when governance and transparency consistently fall short. Even when companies settle major legal battles, the obligation to tell investors the full story right away is paramount.
Okay. So from corporate governance challenges to broader financial pressures, let's shift focus to another big name in the SA landscape, MultiChoice Group.
Right. The sources we looked at suggest MultiChoice is bracing for some pretty tough financial results for the year that ended back in March 2025.
What's the headline number we're seeing for their profit outlook?
Well, the big number is that MultiChoice expects its reported trading profit to fall sharply by about 50%.
50%. That's a huge drop. Now, that's reported profit, which includes currency impacts, right?
Yes, exactly. That figure reflects the combined performance across all the African countries they operate in, including the often significant impact of currency fluctuations when translating those earnings back into rand.
So the sources also mention an organic performance figure, which tries to strip out those currency effects.
They do. And that gives you a slightly clearer view of the underlying operational performance. On that organic basis, stripping out Forex and some other items, trading profit is still expected to decline, but by a smaller amount, somewhere in the range of 7% to 11%.
Okay, so still down, but currency is clearly a massive factor driving that 50% reported drop.
A very big factor, yes.
But here's where it gets a bit counterintuitive, maybe. The sources also talk about an improvement in earnings per share, EPS, and headline earnings per share, HEPS. How does that square with falling profits?
Yeah, that's a really important point, and it highlights why you need to look beyond just one metric in financial results. EPS is actually expected to swing from a loss last year, our 9.35 per share loss, to a profit this year.
A swing from loss to profit.
Yes. And HEPS, headline earnings per share, is projected to jump by as much as 66%.
Okay, wait. Reported profit down 50%, organic profit down maybe 10%, but earnings per share swinging to profit and HEPS up potentially 66%. How does that work?
This is where the sources provide that crucial bit of context.
That makes sense. It's financial engineering, essentially, rather than core operational improvement driving those per share numbers up. So if the underlying operations are weaker, leading to that drop in organic trading profit, what are the reasons MultiChoice is giving?
They're pointing to what they call a continuation of unprecedented financial disruption across their markets in sub-Saharan Africa.
Unprecedented disruption. What does that entail specifically?
It's a cocktail of tough macroeconomic factors, really. Weaker average exchange rates are a big one. As we discussed, they earn less in rand terms from foreign operations. Then you've got high inflation across many markets, rising interest rates making borrowing more expensive.
And the ever-present issue of power supply here in Eze.
Exactly. Load shedding adds significant operational costs for backup power and disrupts service delivery. But it's not just the macro stuff.
What else? Industry changes.
Yes. They're facing structural shifts in the industry. The massive rise of piracy continues to eat into potential revenue. There's incredibly intense competition from global streaming giants, Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, Disney Plus, man, you name it.
And even social media competing for eyeballs and ad spend.
Right. Plus, the sources explicitly mention the cost of investing heavily in their own streaming platform, Showmax.
Ah, Showmax. Still a drag on profits for now.
It seems so. The report states Showmax is still in its early stages, especially after the big relaunch with partners NBCUniversal and Sky. It apparently has yet to scale into its cost base.
Meaning the investment needed to build it, market it, run it, it's currently costing more than it's bringing in.
That's the implication. So while it's a crucial investment for their future, right now it's contributing to that lower group trading profit alongside all the external pressures.
So it's a tough environment. Investing for the future while battling macro headwinds and fierce competition. What's MultiChoice saying about their strategy to navigate this?
They're saying they're focusing on what they can control. Things like maintaining pricing discipline, basically, trying to pass on inflationary cost increases where possible.
Right.
Also, trying to grow new revenue streams beyond just subscriptions. And, crucially, driving further cost-cutting and efficiency measures throughout the business. Try and tighten the belt.
Makes sense. Trying to manage costs while finding new income. And all of this financial reporting is happening against the backdrop of that takeover bid from Canal Plus.
Absolutely. France's Groupe Canal Plus has made a firm offer to buy MultiChoice. These financial results, even the expected ones, provide really important context for shareholders, regulators, and Canal Plus themselves as that process unfolds.
And we'll get the final audited numbers soon.
Yes. MultiChoice is set to publish its full results for the year ending March 2025 on June 11th. TechCentral mentioned they'll be covering that in detail, including an interview with the group CEO, Calvo Mawela. So more insight should be coming.
Okay. So for you, the listener, what's the key takeaway from this MultiChoice story?
I think it vividly illustrates just how tough the operating environment is right now for major companies in South Africa and across the continent. It shows how macro factors like currency swings and local issues like load shedding can really bite into profitability.
And the complexity of financial reporting, too.
Definitely. It's a great example of how headline metrics like EPS or HEPS can sometimes be boosted by specific corporate actions, painting a potentially different picture than the underlying operational health shown by trading profit. You really need to look at the whole picture.
It also shows that even established giants have to constantly adapt to changing consumer habits, the move to streaming, the threat of piracy. It's a dynamic, challenging market.
No doubt about it.
You mentioned load shedding again there, impacting multi-choice. It's obviously a huge issue for everyone in SA, but the sources highlight just how severely it hits the ICT sector specifically. Let's dig into that based on the ICASA report.
Yeah, ICASA, the regulator, did an inquiry specifically looking at load shedding's impact on telecoms and broadcasting. And their findings, pretty stark.
What were the main conclusions? How bad is it for these companies?
ICASA concluded it severely disrupts their operations, significantly jacks up their costs, and this is critical. It really damages consumer trust and the reliability of the services they offer. It hits them on multiple fronts.
Can you give some specific examples of the negative effects ICASA identified?
Sure. The report points to frequent downtime of critical infrastructure, like cell towers. That obviously means lost productivity for businesses relying on connectivity and lost revenue for the operators.
Right.
Then, when the power does come back on, you often get network congestion. Everyone's phone tries to reconnect at once, overwhelming the system temporarily.
I think we've all experienced that.
Yeah. And then there are the costs. Huge expenses for backup power, buying generators, batteries, and the ongoing cost of diesel fuel. And from the customer's perspective, it's pure frustration. Service interruptions, dropped calls, slow data, leading to decreased satisfaction.
And the severity escalates with higher stages of load shedding, right? It's not a consistent impact.
Absolutely not. ICASA broke it down. Stage one, generally low impact, mostly manageable. But once you hit stages 2 to 4, it becomes moderate. Companies lean heavily on backups, costs climb, and you start getting service interruptions, specifically because the batteries at cell sites don't have enough time between blackouts to fully recharge.
Ah, the recharge cycle is key.
It is. And beyond stage 4, the report says the challenges increase significantly. You're looking at potential system failures, severely compromised network availability and service quality. Customers might start canceling services or downgrading plans. There's even mention of potential infrastructure damage from the power cycling and risks of job losses or even businesses closing if high stages persist.
That paints a really difficult operational reality. What are the companies actually doing on the ground to try and fight this?
Well, the sources show they've poured huge amounts of money into backup power, generators, batteries, the works. But, and this is a crucial finding from ICASA, these measures are seen as not fully sufficient.
Not enough.
They help mitigate the impact, yes. But they don't completely solve the problem, especially during prolonged outages or at those very high stages. The systems just weren't designed for this level of constant disruption.
And there are other obstacles even to deploying backup power.
Unfortunately, yes. Crime is a major one mentioned. Theft and vandalism of valuable batteries and generators at cell sites is a serious problem in some areas, making it difficult and expensive to maintain backup systems.
So they invest millions and then it gets stolen.
It's a massive headache. Mm-hmm. Plus, the constant cycling of power on and off causes equipment to malfunction more often, increasing maintenance needs and costs. It's a vicious cycle.
Did ICASA mention any specific examples of what companies are trying?
They did. Companies like Vodacom, Kagiso Media, the broadcaster, and fiber company Vumatel are highlighted as investing heavily in solar power. They see it as a critical strategy now, not just for sustainability, but for operational resilience, reducing reliance on both the grid and expensive diesel.
Makes sense. What else?
Others like Telkom and Vodacom are focused on energy efficiency, optimizing base stations and data centers, using more efficient equipment. MTN and Telkom are boosting network resilience, installing better rectifiers, bigger batteries for longer backup.
Trying to make the infrastructure tougher and less power hungry.
Exactly. And broadcasters like MultiChoice and eMedia, they're using content strategies, pop-up channels, re-airing shows missed during outages, trying to keep viewers engaged despite disruptions.
So lots of effort, but still fundamental challenges.
Mm-hmm.
How's the regulator ICASA responding from a policy angle? Are they offering any relief?
They seem aware of the extreme pressure. ICASA has indicated they're open to looking at amending regulations that might be impossible for companies to comply with because of load shedding.
Okay.
They've also floated the idea of regulatory forbearance, basically offering some flexibility or leniency on compliance rules on a case-by-case basis if a company can clearly show the non-compliance was directly caused by power outages.
A pragmatic approach, perhaps. Now, related to energy, Vodacom made a big announcement recently about renewables, didn't they?
They did. A pretty significant one. Vodacom Group announced that it now sources 100% of its purchased electricity across its operations from renewable sources.
100%. How are they managing that? That sounds like a huge achievement.
It's a combination of things. They're doing on-site solar installations at their own facilities. They're signing power purchase agreements, PPAs, to buy electricity directly from independent renewable energy producers.
Right.
And crucially, for the portion of electricity they still draw from the grid that isn't covered by those direct sources, they are buying renewable energy certificates, or RECs.
Explain RECs quickly.
Sure. A REC represents proof that 1 megawatt hour of electricity was generated from a renewable source and fed into the grid. By buying RECs equivalent to their grid consumption, Vodacom can effectively claim that their total purchased electricity footprint is covered by renewables, even if the specific electrons reaching their building came from ESCOM's mixed grid.
Okay, so it's a way to account for and support renewable generation matching their consumption. What kind of scale are we talking?
Their total energy use was massive, over 2,000 gigawatt hours last year. About 1,275 gigawatt hours of that was purchased electricity. Of that purchased amount, around 900 gigawatt-hours still came from the grid. And that's the portion they offset using RECs to hit the 100% renewable procurement claim.
And this fits into their bigger climate goals.
Absolutely. It's a key step towards their target of net zero greenhouse gas emissions in their direct operations by 2035.
They're also working on something called virtual wheeling. What's that about?
Yeah, this is quite interesting and forward-looking. Vodacom is working with ESCOM and its own subsidiary, Mezzanine, to develop a system for virtual wheeling.
How does virtual wheeling work?
The idea is it would allow Vodacom or other companies to sign a PPA with a renewable energy producer located, say, way up in the Northern Cape, even if Vodacom's main data center is in Gauteng. ESCOM's grid is used to wheel the power, but the system virtually tracks and allocates that renewable energy purchase to Vodacom's consumption, even though the physical power flows mix on the grid.
So it makes it easier to access renewable power regardless of location.
Potentially, yes. Mm. It simplifies the process compared to direct physical wheeling. Vodacom South Africa hopes to be one of the first participants, maybe starting late 2025.
That sounds promising. But even with all this solar, RECs, virtual wheeling, they still face the basic problem of grid unreliability in some places, right?
Absolutely. In areas with poor or no grid power, they still have to rely on diesel generators and batteries. They're trying to shift more towards batteries and away from diesel for environmental reasons, but diesel is often still necessary. They're also exploring other options like fiber links instead of power-hungry radio, wind power where viable, even things like microturbines and hydrogen fuel cells for remote sites.
It's clearly a massive ongoing operational challenge. Now, how does all this, the cost of load shedding, the investment in backup power, the energy procurement strategies, link back to the other big regulatory issue, Spectrum?
The link is fundamental. Think about it.
Mm.
The cost and reliability of power directly impact an operator's ability to actually use the spectrum they acquire. Spectrum is useless without powered base stations.
Right.
When operators have to spend billions on generators, diesel, batteries, security to protect that equipment, it massively inflates their operating expenses. Those costs have to be factored into the business case when they bid for new spectrum licenses. It increases the cost and complexity of deploying that spectrum, especially for things like 5G, which needs a denser network of sites, all needing reliable power.
So unreliable power makes rolling out new spectrum more expensive and potentially slower.
And speaking of spectrum, ICASA is planning another auction, but it seems delayed.
Yes, another spectrum sale is on the cards, but it's been pushed out, now expected, in ICASA's 2027 financial year, so sometime before March 2027.
What bands are potentially up for grabs? The ones previously identified include some really useful frequencies for coverage and capacity. The 750 and 800 megahertz bands, 1.5 gigahertz, 2.3 gigahertz, and 3.3 gigahertz, and 3.5 gigahertz. All valuable stuff for mobile operators.
Okay. But there's also a specific fight brewing over one particular band, 6 gigahertz.
Ah, yes, the 6 gigahertz battle. This is a really significant global debate that's now playing out locally, too. We're talking about the chunk of spectrum from roughly 5.9 gigahertz up to 7.1 gigahertz.
And what's the fight about? Who wants it?
It boils down to mobile versus Wi-Fi. Mobile operators see huge potential in this band for extra capacity for 5G and future 6G services, especially in crowded cities. But the Wi-Fi industry wants it allocated for unlicensed use to power the next generations of super fast Wi-Fi Think, Wi-Fi 6E, and Wi-Fi 7.
So licensed mobile capacity versus unlicensed public Wi-Fi boost, and different countries are choosing different paths.
Exactly. It's a real patchwork globally. The US, Canada, South Korea, Saudi Arabia, they've given the whole band over to unlicensed Wi-Fi. The UK split it, lower part for Wi-Fi, upper part for mobile. China, They went the other way entirely, dedicating the whole band to mobile, eyeing 6G.
And where does South Africa stand?
Well, the lower part of the 6 gigahertz band is already designated for unlicensed Wi-Fi here. But the big question mark hangs over the larger upper portion of the band. That decision is still pending.
What are the local arguments being made about that upper 6 gigahertz slice?
You have groups like WAPA, the Wireless Access Providers Association, suggesting that maybe some kind of sharing could work. Apparently, ICASIASA has even done some experiments with dynamic spectrum sharing tech.
But the mobile operators are less keen on sharing.
Seems so. Vodacom's perspective, as captured in the sources, is that successful sharing between mass-market mobile and license-exempt services in these bands is rare and mostly experimental. They argue that upper 6 gigahertz offers vital capacity needed for mobile services, IMT, especially in dense areas, and assigning it to mobile would give users a more consistent, reliable experience, particularly when moving around.
So it's a classic regulatory dilemma. How best to allocate a scarce, valuable resource? These delays in the auction and these debates must have consequences, right?
They do. Vodacom, for instance, argued that delaying the next big spectrum auction until potentially 2027 could actually harm consumers by postponing the rollout of spectrum that could improve services, especially in underserved rural areas.
And beyond just getting the spectrum, the cost of it is a huge issue for operators here.
A massive point of contention. The sources highlight a direct disagreement. A GSMA report suggested SA spectrum costs were relatively cost-effective globally.
But the local industry disagrees.
Strongly. ACT, the Association for Comms and Technology, representing the major operators, pushed back hard. Their CEO, Nomvuyiso Bathi, said their own research shows South Africa is actually among the most expensive globally for spectrum.
What was her criticism of ICASA's approach?
She pointed to an unclear pricing framework and argued that the regulator doesn't seem to properly weigh the impact of high spectrum prices on operator investment, potential pass-through costs to customers, and the overall cost of network rollout.
And Vodacom added more context to those costs.
Yes. They emphasized that it's not just the auction price. The obligations attached to spectrum licenses in SA are often very demanding and add significantly to the total cost. Plus, they reiterated the unique operational costs here fighting theft and vandalism, and the huge expense of running generators and diesel simply because of load shedding. These costs aren't typical elsewhere and make high spectrum prices even harder to swallow.
Okay, let's wrap this section. What should you, the listener, take away from this discussion on load shedding's impact and the spectrum battles?
Two main things, I think. First, load shedding isn't just an annoyance for you. It's a massive operational and financial drain on the companies providing your connectivity. It directly affects service reliability and inflates costs, which in turn influences how quickly they can invest in and deploy better technology.
And second point.
Regulatory decisions about spectrum, who gets what band, like 6 gigahertz, and how much it costs directly shape the quality, availability, and ultimately the price of your mobile and internet services. High costs, whether from spectrum fees or operational challenges like power, can act as a brake on the technological progress you experience as a consumer. These debates really matter for your digital life.
That's a great segue into our next topic, which also sits right at the intersection of regulation, global tech, and local policy. I'm talking about the Starlink situation and South Africa's BEE policy.
Yes, the Starlink saga. This has definitely generated a lot of headlines. The core issue, as reported by Tech Central, is SpaceX Starlink's parent company basically saying South Africa's local ownership rules, specifically the BEE requirements, are a major hurdle for them launching formally here.
They see it as a barrier to entry. How's the government responding?
The official line is, yes, we'll review ICT sector rules, but no, we're not abandoning fundamental transformation policies like BEE.
But there was a specific move by the communications minister, Sali Malatsi, recently that seemed aimed at this issue.
There was. Minister Malatsi proposed a policy directive. He wants to ask ICASA to explore using something called Equity Equivalence Investment Programs, EEIPs, as an alternative way for companies to meet licensing requirements.
EEIPs, what are they exactly? How do they differ from the standard BEE equity ownership model?
So instead of requiring a foreign company like Starlink to sell off a 30% equity stake to historically disadvantaged South Africans, an EEIP allows them to invest an equivalent monetary value into approved local development projects.
Like skills training or supporting small black-owned businesses.
Exactly. Things like that. It's an alternative path recognized in the existing Electronic Communications Act and apparently used in other sectors, like the motor industry. You invest in transformation rather than transferring ownership for transformation.
And the timing of this proposal was quite notable, wasn't it?
It certainly raised eyebrows. It came shortly after President Ramaphosa met former U.S. President Trump, and reports surfaced that Starlink's entry into SA was discussed, given Elon Musk's public criticism of the 30% equity rule.
The perception was this EEIP idea was basically a way to solve Starlink's problem.
That was definitely the narrative doing the rounds. But the industry body, ACT, representing the existing mobile operators, had something to say about that.
What was ACT's take on EEIPs?
Their CEO, Namvi Sobhati, said they actually support EEIPs in principle. They're already allowed under the act, used elsewhere, it's a valid mechanism.
But they had a big but.
A very big but. Their absolute key demand was regulatory parity. Fairness. If EEIPs are going to be an option, the rules must apply equally to everyone. Satellite operators like Starlink and the mobile network operators too.
So no special deals just for new foreign entrants. Level the playing field.
Precisely. ACT members, she pointed out, have already invested billions and worked hard to comply with the existing BEE equity rules. If the government wants to offer alternatives like EEIPs, fine, but don't only apply it to the new guys. Make it available across the board. Consistency is key.
Did she address the timing issue? The idea it was just for Starlink?
Yes. She pushed back on that narrative. Batiste stated the process of exploring EEIPs within government, and ICASA was already underway before the Ramaphosa-Trump meeting. She framed it as part of a broader look at aligning the ECA with BEE, not just a knee-jerk reaction for SpaceX.
Interesting. So it's more complex than just fixing it for Starlink.
Seems so. And ACT also demanded parity on other things, too. Universal service obligations, quality of service rules, customer protection, saying they should apply uniformly to SA companies and international players like Starlink.
Now, separate from the BE and regulatory debate, there's another major concern flagged in the sources regarding Starlink operating here. It involves science, specifically radio astronomy.
Yes, this is a really important angle. Astronomers working with South Africa's Incredible Square Kilometer Array Telescope, the SKA, are actively lobbying authorities. They want to ensure any license granted to Starlink or similar satellite constellations includes conditions to protect their extremely sensitive astronomical observations.
What's the specific fear? How could satellites interfere with a giant telescope?
The core worry is that the sheer number of satellites in these low Earth orbit constellations could essentially pollute the radio sky. They beam down signals, and those signals can drown out the incredibly faint natural radio waves coming from distant stars and galaxies that the SKA is designed to detect.
The source used a striking analogy.
They did. Like shining a spotlight into someone's eyes, blinding us to the faint radio signals from celestial bodies. It really captures the potential disruption.
And technically, why is there interference? Are they using the same frequencies?
That's the problem. The current SKA antennas in the Kourou operate in frequency bands that overlap with those used by many satellite operators, including Starlink, for their downlink communications.
So the telescope is trying to listen to whispers from space, and the satellites are shouting right overhead in the same language.
A good way to put it, yes. So the SKA Observatory and our own South African Radio Astronomy Observatory, SARAO, are campaigning globally.
What are they asking for? What kind of protections?
They're pushing for specific mitigation measures to be written into the operating licenses granted by regulators like ICASA. Things like requiring satellite operators to actively steer their transmission beams away from the sensitive SKA site during observations. Or even potentially pausing transmissions briefly when a satellite passes directly over the core telescope area during critical science work.
This seems like a growing global challenge with thousands more satellites planned.
It is. This campaign isn't just about Starlink and SA. They're engaging with Amazon's Kuiper project, Eutelsat's OneWeb, all the major players, trying to establish international norms to protect radio astronomy's need for quiet skies in this era of mega constellations.
Okay, so pulling this whole complex Starlink thread together, BEE regulation, EEIPs, SKA protection, what's the takeaway for you, the listener?
I think it perfectly encapsulates the balancing act governments face. How do you welcome potentially beneficial new global tech like satellite internet while upholding national priorities like economic transformation? And how do you manage the impact on existing critical infrastructure, whether it's mobile networks or world-class scientific instruments? It forces questions about fairness and regulation. Should everyone play by the exact same rules, or are alternative paths okay? And how do you referee competing demands for finite resources like radio frequencies? It shows that integrating global tech locally is rarely straightforward. There are always trade-offs and complexities.
Right. Let's shift away from the complexities of regulation now. and look at some straightforward market activity and growth in different sectors. The sources highlight some interesting moves by smaller players and new entrants.
Yeah, let's start with the MVNO market, mobile virtual network operators.
Quick refresher, MVNOs.
They're mobile providers who don't own their own network towers. They basically rent capacity wholesale from the big guys, Vodacom, MTN, Cell C, and Cell Services under their own brand.
Like FNB Connect or Katik Connect. And the one highlighted here is Mr. Price Cellular.
Exactly. The MVNO run by the retailer, Mr. Price. And the news is they're gaining traction, making inroads in the market.
Do we know by how much?
The source cites GfK research showing the Mr. Price Group's telecom activities, that's both the MVNO and their power cell phone accessory stores, saw a 40 basis point gain in market share over the year ending March 2025.
40 basis points. Doesn't sound huge, but in a mature market like SA Telecoms.
It's a respectable gain. They didn't reveal the actual market share number, but the growth is positive. And their segment sales were up too.
How much were sales up?
Sales for that telecoms and cellular segment rose 13.2% to R1.3 billion.
So why are retailers like Mr. Price doing this? What's the strategic play with MVNOs?
It's largely about customer loyalty and stickiness. Offering mobile services gives them another regular connection point with their customers, keeps people within their brand ecosystem. It's about building that relationship beyond just selling clothes or homeware.
And it's proving profitable for them.
The sources say yes. The segment, which includes both standalone stores and store-in-store concepts, continues to grow its profitability.
What's helping drive that growth?
They launched their own private label phone called Salt back in March 2024. That likely helps margins. And they have a really high accessories attachment rate, 69%.
Mm-hmm.
So most people buying a phone are also buying cases, chargers, etc., boosting the value of each sale.
Clever bundling. And this all fits into the bigger Mr. Price Group results.
Yeah, this positive performance in cellular contributed to the overall group doing pretty well. Group earnings were up 10.1%, revenue up 7.9% to nearly R41 billion. They had a strong second half.
Okay, so that's MVNOs making moves. Another area seeing activity is the electric vehicle market, specifically BYD expanding its footprint.
Yes, BYD, the big Chinese EV maker, sometimes called China's Tesla. They've got ambitious plans for South Africa.
What were they planning?
They aim to nearly triple their dealership network here by 2026.
Triple? Where are they now? They only launched recently, right?
Yeah, they launched officially in 2023 with the Atto 3 EV. Currently, they have about 13 dealerships.
And the plan is to get to?
Around 20 dealerships by the end of this year, 2025. And then push on to 30 or 35 dealerships during 2026.
That's aggressive expansion. And it's happening as the SA car market sees more Chinese competition generally and rising interest in EVs, or NEVs as they call them.
Exactly. Brands like GAC, Chery, GWM are all active. And the NEV sales numbers are telling. NAMSA data showed NEV sales jumped from about 7,800 in 2023 to over 15,600 in 2024. Still a small slice of the total pie, but doubling year on year is significant growth.
What's BYD's stated strategy for SA, given the EV market is still pretty small here overall?
Their SA general manager, Steve Chang, basically said they want to get in early, help educate the market, cultivate demand, and position themselves for when the transition to EVs really takes off here. He wants to help South Africans catch up with the rest of the world on EVs.
What models are they offering now? Is it just pure electric?
No, they've got a mix. They have six models available now. It includes plug-in hybrids like the Shark 6 Baki and the Celian 6 SUV, alongside pure electrics like the Atto 3 and the new Celian 7 SUV. So a dual strategy offering both hybrid and full EV options.
What are the big hurdles they still face in SA? The usual suspects.
Pretty much. The sources mention the familiar challenges. Limited public charging infrastructure, the unstable power supply affecting charging reliability, and EVs facing higher import duties than petrol diesel cars, which impacts affordability.
But despite all that, BYD clearly sees potential here.
They really do. Steve Chang's comments were quite bullish. He called South Africa one of the most important automotive markets in the Southern Hemisphere, maybe the biggest in Africa. He said it's a market they have to look at and see how we can develop.
So they see SA as a key strategic market, maybe even a gateway to the rest of Africa.
That seems to be the thinking. Long-term potential.
Okay, so looking at these two stories, Mr. Price Cellular and BYD, what should you, the listener, take away?
Well, they showed different kinds of growth and competition happening. The MVNO story shows how non-traditional players can carve out niches and offer consumers more choice, leveraging existing strengths like retail presence.
And the BYD story.
That signals serious intent from a major global player in the EV space, despite SAE's current challenges. It suggests that even if the transition takes time, the push towards electric mobility here is real, and you're likely to see more and more EV options becoming available in the coming years. It also puts more pressure on sorting out that charging infrastructure.
Right. Now let's shift from four wheels to the device in your pocket, the high-end smartphone market. The sources give us a glimpse of the latest trends and, well, the frankly astonishing prices at the very top.
Yeah, the premium end of the smartphone market is definitely being reshaped, primarily by foldable phones driving up the price ceiling.
Foldables are dominating the high-end price list.
According to the list TechCentral compiled, yes. Four out of the top five most expensive phones currently sold in South Africa are foldables.
What's the main selling point manufacturers are pushing with these devices?
The core idea is versatility. You get a normal size pocketable phone when it's closed, but open it up, and you get a much larger tablet-like screen for better productivity or media consumption, trying to be the best of both worlds.
Sounds technically challenging to build.
Hugely. Making displays that can bend hundreds of thousands of times without breaking or showing a horrible crease. Packing powerful chips and cameras into super thin profiles. Getting decent battery life. It's complex engineering.
Samsung really led the way initially, didn't they?
They did. The first Galaxy Fold came out back in 2019. And last year, their Fold 5 was the priciest phone on this list.
But not anymore. Who's taken the crown for most expensive phone in SA now?
This year, it's the Huawei Mate XT Ultimate. And this one's even more ambitious. It's a trifold design.
Trifold. Two hinges.
Exactly. It folds into three sections, offering different screen sizes and form factors. When it's fully open, it boasts a 10.2-inch screen, but it's incredibly thin, just 3.6 millimeters at its slimmest point. Fold it up, it's about 12.8 millimeter thick.
Impressive engineering. What about specs and the price tag?
It packs 16 GB of RAM and a huge 1 TB of storage. And the price are 70,000.
70,000 Rand. Okay, that's firmly in luxury territory. Who else is on that pricey foldable list?
Samsung's still right up there. Their Galaxy Z Fold 6 with 512 GB of storage is number two at R46,000. The 256 GB version is number four at R43,500. And we expect a Fold 7 fairly soon, which might shake things up again. Huawei also has another foldable, the two-screen Mate XT, at number three, costing R45,000. And just outside the top five, at number six, is the Honor Magic V2 at R40,000. That one made waves for being super thin when it launched here in April, 9.9 millimeter folded, though Honor already has an even thinner V3 out in China.
So foldables are definitely the main story at the absolute peak of the market. But the sources also mention another trend emerging, or maybe re-emerging, super thin phones.
Yeah, it's interesting. Remember about 10 years ago, the race to make the thinnest phone possible?
I do. Seems like that faded as focus shifted to bigger batteries and better cameras, making phones thicker.
Exactly. But now, in 2025, the sources suggest that obsession with thinness is back. Samsung kicked it off with a new model, the Galaxy S25 Edge, and Apple is rumored to be following with a super skinny iPhone soon.
Why now? What's driving this return to thinness?
The TechCentral review speculates it might be a sort of temporary phase and interregnum before foldables truly hit the mainstream. Foldables are still very expensive, and maybe some consumers are still skeptical about durability. Plus, overall, smartphone sales aren't exactly booming, so manufacturers might be trying different design angles, like extreme thinness, to create some excitement.
Let's look at that Galaxy S25 Edge review mentioned in the sources. What's it like using a phone prioritizing thinness above all else? Price is around $1,100 US.
Yeah, so maybe around our $20,000 here. The review says the most striking thing is how light it feels, 163 grams. Almost like a dummy phone, it's so floaty.
How's the performance? Did it sacrifice speed for thinness?
Apparently not. Performance is said to be top tier, on par with other premium phones, thanks to the fast Snapdragon 8 Elite chip inside.
And the camera. It shares the main sensor with the top dog S25 Ultra.
It does, that big 200 megapixel sensor. The review praises the sharp, vibrant images and says the portrait mode blur is particularly good. Decent in low light, too.
Any camera downsides mentioned?
Couple. It lacks a dedicated telephoto lens, so your optical zoom is limited compared to the Ultra. And apparently the software can sometimes struggle with capturing moving subjects like pets or people clearly in dim light unless you fiddle with advanced modes.
What about the build? Does it feel fragile being so thin? 5.8 millimeter?
The review notes the use of a titanium frame, which helps it feel surprisingly durable despite the thinness. The screen uses tough Corning glass ceramic too. One minor downside, no anti-glare coating like the S25 Ultra, so harder to see in bright sun.
And sound often suffers in thin phones.
Surprisingly, the speakers are described as sounding relatively normal, not thin or tinny, despite the lack of space.
Okay, so performance, camera, mostly build, sound, seem pretty good. But there has to be a catch with a phone this thin, surely.
There usually is.
Yeah.
And yes, the review points directly to it. Battery life. It's flagged as the main weakness, a direct consequence of prioritizing that ultra-slim design.
How bad is it? Smaller battery capacity.
Yes. It has less battery capacity than even the standard S25 model. Samsung tries to make up for it with software optimizations for efficiency.
But for heavy users.
It's likely not enough. The review suggests power users will probably need to recharge before the day is out. Wireless charging helps for top-ups. But the 25W wired charging is noticeably slower than the S25 Ultra's 45W.
And heavy use drains it fast.
Definitely. Using the camera a lot,
mm-hmm.
gaming, streaming video that hits the battery hard. It can last a full day with moderate use, social media, messaging, music. But push it, and you'll be reaching for the charger by evening.
And there's a long-term concern, too.
Right. The reviewer points out that battery health naturally degrades over time. If the runtime is already mediocre when new, it's only going to get worse as the battery ages.
So the S25 Edge highlights the trade-off. You can have ultra-thin, but be prepared to compromise significantly on battery life.
That seems to be the clear message. And the big question is whether consumers actually want this trade-off. Did anyone ask for super-thin phones to come back if it means worse battery? Manufacturers are trying it. But it remains to be seen if it resonates.
Looking back at that list of most expensive phones besides the foldables, who else was there? Apple, presumably?
Oh, yes. The iPhone 16 Pro Max with 1 terabyte of storage is number 5 at R43,000. It's the only traditional slab phone in the top 5, which says a lot about Apple's pricing power.
Still no Apple foldable, though there are rumors.
Constant rumors. Maybe 2026 or 2027, the speculation goes.
Mm-hmm.
The list also features other iPhone 16 Pro Max variants, and it highlights the hefty premium Apple charges just for storage, like R6000 more for the 1TB Pro Max compared to the 512GB.
And Samsung's main non-folding flagship, the S25 Ultra.
That makes the list too, but further down at number 9, the 1TB S25 Ultra comes in at R36,000. It's the only non-folding, non-iPhone in the top 10.
So what does this snapshot of the high-end tell you, the listener?
It shows where the cutting edge and the highest prices are right now. Foldables are moving from niche to being the defining feature of the ultra-premium segment, offering that phone-tablet hybrid experience, but costing a fortune. The return of the thinness trend shows manufacturers exploring other design angles, but also serves as a reminder that design choices have real consequences, especially for crucial things like battery life. It helps you understand what you're paying for at the top and the compromises involved.
Okay, let's move from the very tangible world of hardware to the increasingly digital realm of finance. Let's talk about stablecoins.
Right. This is the fascinating area with potentially huge implications. So a stablecoin, fundamentally, is a type of digital currency, a crypto asset, but it's designed to hold a steady value. Usually it's pegged one-to-one to a traditional fiat currency, most often the U.S. dollar.
So unlike Bitcoin or Ether that bounce around wildly in price, a stablecoin aims to be stable.
Exactly. That's the whole point. The crazy volatility of traditional crypto makes it great for speculation, maybe, but pretty useless for buying your groceries or storing your savings reliably. Stablecoins try to offer the benefits of digital assets, like potentially faster, cheaper transactions on a blockchain, but with the price stability of, say, the dollar or the euro.
How do they maintain that peg? How do they stay stable?
The most common and reputable way is through full reserve backing. For every $1 stablecoin issued, like USDC or USDT, the issuer holds $1 worth of real assets in reserve.
What kind of assets?
Typically, actual U.S. dollars in audited bank accounts, or very safe, liquid assets like short-term U.S. government treasuries. The idea is that the digital coin is always redeemable for the underlying asset, which keeps its value anchored.
And the sources highlight that these stablecoins aren't just niche crypto things anymore. Big finance players are getting involved.
This is the crucial shift happening now. Mainstream companies are embracing them. PayPal, the huge online payment firm, launched its own stablecoin. Visa, the global card network, is actively investing in fintechs that enable stablecoin payments, like a company called BVNK mentioned in the sources.
Wow,
Visa.
Yeah. And Circle, the issuer of USDC, runs a payments network using stablecoins for real time. 247 cross-border payments. The sources contrast this with traditional international bank transfers, which can be slow, expensive, and often take days, especially in emerging markets.
Is Visa actually using stablecoins in its consumer products?
They are experimenting. They launched a product in Latin America, allowing people to pay with stablecoins via a Visa card. The plan is apparently to expand this to Africa and Asia soon. This could be really useful in places with high inflation, allowing people to hold value in a dollar-pegged stablecoin.
And the plumbing behind these systems is attracting big money, too.
Absolutely. A company called Bridge, which builds stablecoin payment infrastructure and works with Visa, was just bought by Stripe. Stripe is a massive global payments company, valued at over $90 billion. That acquisition tells you Stripe sees strategic value in stablecoin tech.
So PayPal, Visa, Stripe, these are heavy hitters. It signals stablecoins are being seen as serious tools for faster, cheaper payments.
It's a clear sign that mainstream finance is looking seriously at blockchain and stablecoins to improve the existing, often clunky, payment rails.
What about regulation? If these are becoming mainstream, regulators must be looking closely. Where does SA stand?
Globally, yes, there's a big push to regulate stablecoins. But the sources suggest South Africa is, unfortunately, lagging a bit behind the curve.
What are other countries doing? Any examples?
The U.S. is making moves. There's proposed legislation called the Genius Act, catchy name, specifically aimed at regulating stablecoins.
What would the Genius Act do?
A key part is requiring stablecoin issuers to maintain full 1.1 backing with high-quality reserve assets. It's about ensuring stability and consumer protection.
And what does U.S. progress signal globally?
The author of the piece, Mary Wrights from Luno, argues it shows the U.S. is getting ready to integrate stablecoins and crypto more broadly into the traditional financial system, but with clear guardrails. And typically, where the U.S. leads on financial regulation, others tend to follow.
But South Africa's position?
Wrights describes SA as increasingly watching from the sidelines, which is ironic because other data, even from SARS, suggests South Africans have relatively high rates of Bitcoin adoption. But we still lack a comprehensive regulatory framework for digital assets overall.
And this lack of clarity creates problems.
It does. It chills innovation locally and makes investors, especially institutional ones, hesitant.
What are the key unanswered regulatory questions here?
A really big one highlighted is classification. Should crypto assets be treated as onshore or offshore assets for investment purposes? This matters hugely for retirement funds, for instance, which face strict limits on how much they can invest offshore. If crypto is deemed offshore, it severely restricts local institutional investment, regardless of the potential.
So regulatory uncertainty acts as a major barrier. What's the author's main argument for SA?
Wrights argues that with stablecoins now being integrated by global giants like Visa and MasterCard, digital assets are undeniably going mainstream. South Africa can't afford to ignore this trend or dismiss it as niche anymore.
So regulators need to act.
Yes. He urges a serious debate, not just about risks, which are real, but about how SA can position itself competitively in this new financial landscape.
What are the potential upsides if SA gets regulation right?
Clear, forward-looking rules could foster a thriving domestic digital asset ecosystem, unlock investment, create tax revenue, and importantly, allow South Africans and businesses to actually benefit from the efficiencies stablecoins offer, like those faster, cheaper cross-border payments.
So why should you, the listener, care about stablecoins and SA's regulatory stance?
Because stablecoins could genuinely change how money moves globally. Faster, cheaper international transfers could impact you directly if you send or receive money overseas, or even how you pay for things online. Whether South Africa creates a clear path for these innovations will determine if you and local businesses can easily tap into these benefits, or if we risk getting left behind as global finance evolves. It's definitely a space to watch.
Right. As we head towards the finish line of this deep dive, let's quickly cover some executive changes mentioned in the sources. Leadership moves can sometimes signal shifts in strategy.
Good idea. First up, Prosus, the international tech investment arm of Naspers.
What's the news there?
Irvin Tu, who was the group president and chief investment officer, is stepping down from those executive roles.
Leaving the company?
No, he's staying on, but in an advisory capacity.
What was his contribution? He seemed quite central.
He was. He joined in 2021 and led some key initiatives, simplifying their complicated group structure, boosting financial performance, managing that big share buyback program, and improving the investment team's operations. He also helped with the recent CEO transition to Fabrizio Bluisi.
And this comes as Prosus itself is trying to transform.
Exactly. They're shifting strategy, trying to become more of an operating tech company, focused on building e-commerce businesses in places like Latin America, India, and Europe, not just managing investments.
Okay. Next, Vodacom Group, another company we discussed earlier, an appointment there.
Yes, a significant one. Mohamed Abdallah has been appointed to a consolidated role as CEO of International Markets and Vodafone Egypt.
Combining roles, what's the rationale?
Vodacom says it's about simplifying their international operating model, driving growth and improving customer experience by bringing oversight together.
So Abdallah was already CEO of Vodafone Egypt.
Yes, a huge market for them. Now his portfolio expands to include executive oversight for several other key African markets as well.
Which one?
The CEOs of Vodacom DRC, Lesotho, Mozambique, and Tanzania will now report up to him, and he continues reporting to the group CEO, Shamil Jusub. It streamlines the structure.
What's Abdallah's background?
Deep experience within Vodafone. 27 years with Vodafone Egypt, held senior roles, credited with strong growth there. He takes over the broader international responsibilities from Diego Gutierrez, who left in April.
So a seasoned internal appointment. Why do these executive shuffles matter to you, the listener?
Leadership changes like these can often signal strategic shifts, a doubling down on certain areas or efforts to improve efficiency, like the restructuring at Vodacom. For you as a customer or just an observer, it's a small window into the moves happening inside the major companies that provide your tech services or influence the market.
Okay, finally, one last story. This one's global in scale, but has very significant implications for Africa. It involves Bill Gates and his foundation.
Yes, this is about a massive philanthropic commitment. Bill Gates announced plans for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to give away U.S. $200 billion over the next 20 years.
$200 billion, that's staggering. What's the long-term plan for the foundation itself?
The goal is actually for the foundation to wind down its operations by 2045. Gates has personally pledged to give away 99% of his own wealth, currently around 175 billion pounds by then. So this 200 billion pound spend over two decades is a huge part of that distribution.
And Africa is a major focus of this funding.
Explicitly so. Gates stated recently at an African Union meeting in Addis Ababa, and I quote from the source, "The majority of that funding will be spent on helping you address challenges here in Africa."
The Gates Foundation has already invested heavily in Africa over the years, hasn't it?
They have. They've dispersed over $100 billion globally since 2000. A lot of that has gone into African health initiatives, funding scientists working on malaria, TB, agriculture, and so on. This new commitment represents a significant scaling up and confirmed focus on the continent.
So why is this relevant in our tech deep dive? How does it connect?
While it's philanthropy, not strictly tech investment, $200 billion directed at African challenges is hugely relevant. Many of those challenges in health, farming, education, financial inclusion are areas where technology plays a critical role as an enabler or a solution. This scale of funding often supports research, infrastructure development, and pilot projects that can directly or indirectly boost technological adoption and innovation on the continent. It signals a massive flow of capital and global attention focused on solving African problems, which inevitably intersects with the tech landscape here. It's part of the broader context shaping development and opportunity.
Wow. Okay, we have certainly covered a lot of ground today.
We really have, from the specifics of IO's JSE censure and the importance of governance.
The intense financial pressures facing multi-choice for macro issues and industry disruption.
The deep impact of load shedding on ICT operations and the complex regulatory fights over spectrum.
The whole Starlink situation, balancing BEE policy, global tech entry, and protecting the SKA.
Then market growth stories like Mr. Price Cellular in the MVNO space and BYD's big push into EVs.
A look at the bleeding edge of smartphones with pricey foldables and the return of ultra-thin designs with their trade-offs.
The rise of stablecoins and the urgent need for regulatory clarity in South Africa for digital finance.
Plus those key executive moves at Prosus and Vodacom and that massive Gates Foundation commitment to Africa.
Phew. Yeah, diving into these top stories from Tech Central really gives you, hopefully, a much richer sense of the South African tech scene right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's complex, it's challenging, but it's also incredibly dynamic.
Definitely shaped by unique local issues like infrastructure alongside global tech trends and investment flows.
Absolutely.
And of course, this is just a snapshot. There's always more happening, more detail behind every story.
Which is why, if you want to stay right on top of the latest technology news and analysis coming out of South Africa, you should really check out the source of all this material, Tech Central. You can find them online at techcentral.co.za.
That's techcentral.co.za. Highly recommended.
Definitely worth keeping bookmarked.
So as we wrap up, maybe a final thought to leave you with. We've seen this fascinating mix today, haven't we? Deep-seated domestic challenges, load-shedding regulatory hurdles, governance issues colliding head-on with the momentum of new tech like EVs and stablecoins, powerful global players knocking on the door, and even huge international philanthropic focus. What does this unique blend of local friction and global force mean for the actual speed of technological progress, for access to these new services, and for ensuring everyone in South Africa can participate fairly in the digital future that's unfolding?
That's the multi-billion rand question, isn't it? And the answer is playing out right now in the stories we see every week. Something definitely worth keeping an eye on.
Indeed. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Pleasure, as always. Until next time.